Well, I seem to be giving an awful lot of lectures, and I'm getting near the end of anything I understand, and maybe some people will think beyond it. I was going to begin today by talking about Poincaré's reality, and in fact that's the goal of where I am going to get to also in the end of my last lecture tomorrow, if I get that far. But in between, the route is going to be somewhat circuitous. So I said in yesterday's lecture that if we want to go beyond the framework of homotopy theory and actually study manifolds, then the thing we want to understand is Poincaré duality. Because what singles out manifolds among spaces is the pairing between the homology and cohomology. If we have a compact oriented N-manifold, then the homology of X, let's say with rational coefficients, is dual to the cohomology in the complementary dimension. Now the statement over the integers is already slightly more complicated, but has more information in it. Anyway, this is extremely diagnostic for the property of being an n-dimensional manifold. So one would like to put as much geometric content as possible into statements of this kind, to sort of extract as much juice from it as one can, and try to sort of promote it to a statement which carries more information. And then one might try to see how one can find statements of this kind in non-commutative geometry, or perhaps even better for things like string backgrounds. Well, if one thinks historically, what was the first way this thing was observed? People took the manifold and they triangulated it, and then they said there was a dual triangulation. So imagine you have a piece of surface, you divide it up into triangle somehow, and then it was observed that you can make a dual cell decomposition. What you do is you take the vertices of the original thing and you look for the regions which are closer to that vertex than they are to any other vertex. You do that in a kind of piecewise linear way, and you get a dual division where to each vertex of the original thing, there corresponds some top-dimensional cell in the dual subdivision. Then you can make the chains of X in the original simplicial picture. You can make the chains of X in the dual picture. And you find that these chain complexes are exactly dual, that CP of this is exactly dual to the even over the integers, to the homomorphisms of C n minus p of x into z. So the chain complex, the whole chain complex turns upside down. So the cohomology of this is dual to the cohomology of this, but at the same time one has the theorem that if you take a space and you divide it up into cells in two different ways, and by the robustness of the construction of the chain complex, which I talked about in the earlier lecture, these chain complexes are actually equivalent. So one has, on the one hand, an isomorphism of this with the dual of that, on the other hand, an isomorphism of this with this, and putting those two things together, you get Poincaré duality. Now, one reason why I mentioned this dual subdivision picture is one of the things I'd like to get at is some version of S-duality in string theory. And of course the baby archetype, the baby prototype of S-duality is the high and low temperature duality for an Ising model. And I'd like to point out that, you see, what people commonly tell you about that is you take some lattice system with fields of some kind defined at the lattice points, and you want to do some path integral, make some partition function by integrating over all those lattice fields. And people will tell you that this high temperature, low temperature duality in models like that is Fourier transform in the space of fields. And that, of course, is indeed right. You have some function defined on the functions defined on the lattice points here, and you do a Fourier transform. Well, what does that take you to? Well, of course, it takes you to the dual space. Now, the dual space we see from this picture is the functions defined on the dual lattice, and that is the important geometrical content. So I would prefer to think of this Kramers-Wanier duality as something which I'd like to not so much emphasize the Fourier transform aspect of it, as emphasize the fact that it goes to the dual space, which is the space of the dual cell decomposition. And then you can say the dual cell decomposition is essentially a cell decomposition of the same thing. So you can think of this as a transformation inside the same Ising model. But because you go from a function to the Fourier transform of the function, the Fourier transform of the large temperature partition function will be the low temperature partition function, and so on. So I would like to emphasize that Poincaré duality has something to do with these S-dualities in field theory. Well, we'd still like to promote this in some way to a statement that has more teeth in it than just the duality of vector spaces. And there are really two ways to go. You can either promote, one is slightly more precise than the other. You can try to think of cohomology classes as promoted from being just elements of a group to being some kind of actual objects, to forming objects of a category. Or you could do something which is slightly less precise. You could say, well, we make cohomology of whatever kind out of some kind of objects. We could consider the space of all those objects. So we could say we have a space of objects, we have a space of dual objects, and we could try to say that those spaces were homotopy equivalent. Now, it used to be extremely difficult to sell the notion of homotopy equivalence of such spaces to physicists because it seemed very alien to the sort of thing they do. But certainly it's come into its own, really, it seems to me, in string theory in recent times, because, you see, when one makes these string theory spaces and one tries to identify some string theory with another string theory, one actually knows very little of a concrete analytic kind about the spaces. One can pick out some spaces of BPS states, and as I think is what was already pointed out originally in Robert Dykgraff's first lecture, in some sense that's passing from the functions on the space, which are the real subject matter of physics, to some kind of cohomology classes. These BPS states are kind of like harmonic forms. And the basic observation one makes in connection with these BPS state equivalences is that because when you change all the parameters of the theory, homology is rigid, you expect the BPS states, even if you don't know anything about the theory in some strong coupling regime, to stay the same as they were before you deformed the parameters. So homotopy invariance is somehow one of the basic ideas which seems to be being exploited in connection with B-brains and so on recently. So I think I can reasonably well sell you the idea that one would like to promote a statement like this to a statement about saying that some space of objects is homotopy equivalent to some other space of objects. And I've already mentioned, I've already mentioned a number of versions of this. The thing that we did in stable homotopy was to take a compact space and say that if we embedded that in a large Euclidean space and took an open union, took an open neighborhood, then there was a sense in which this space was dual to the one-point compactification of this space. There was a map from this to the one-point compactification of Rn, and back again, which identified each of these spaces with the maps of the other into this sphere, or at least it did in a stable sense. So this was some kind of statement. It's not really the kind that
I'm looking for. But let's pursue it a little bit. This is dual to u of x plus.
These maps will certainly tell us that the cohomology of this for any compact space x, not necessarily a manifold, is dual to the cohomology of that. And it's a considerably stronger statement, but it says that among other things. Now, if x is a manifold, here we have a tubular neighborhood,
then we have the Thom isomorphism theorem, which says this looks as if looks like x again, because we said that if we have x embedded in a space, we look at this tubular neighborhood, then the cohomology with compact supports of the total space of any vector bundle is isomorphic to the cohomology of x.
So this gives you a proof of Poincaré duality, and in fact much stronger than a proof of Poincaré duality in ordinary homology. And it also promotes it to a geometrical statement. What's wrong with it as a geometrical statement is, at least from the point of view of we're taking now, the point of view of physics, is really two things. We'd actually like to say that this is like this. Now, what it's like, obviously, is the one-point compactification of some normal bundle, some infinitesimal thickening. If that normal bundle were trivial, which would be the case if and only if the manifold is what's called stably parallelizable. Parallelizable would mean that the tangent bundle was trivial. That would imply that when you embedded it in a large dimensional space, the normal bundle was trivial. But the normal bundle in large dimension being trivial is a slightly weaker statement. If this thing is stably parallelizable, then you can think of this as just looking like X cross Euclidean space, and then this space will look like the suspension of that, albeit not in a very canonical way. And in that case, you could say that this space is dual to some suspension of itself, and that is in some sense a good statement of Poincaré duality. However, passing from a space to some suspension of itself is not really a very nice thing to do directly in anything connected with physics. The suspension, the thickening up of a space in this way, is somehow a somewhat alien idea. Now, if one wants to look at the space a little bit more brutally, we can look at it through the eyes either of cohomology, which we've already been doing, or of K-theory. I already mentioned how to look at it in the sense through the eyes of K-theory, because of homology. In homology, we start with X and we can form the free abelian group on X. Remember, I mentioned this construction before. So the formal integral linear combination of finite sets of points. I like to think of it as the, as I said, the configurations of all charged bosons on X. On the other hand, we can look at some space of maps of X into this same space associated to an n-dimensional sphere. And in fact, you can derive from this statement an actually much more concrete statement, the statement there's a map from here to here, which is actually a homotopy equivalence. I won't bother to explain that because later on I'll be talking about more interesting versions of the same kind of thing. But you see, this, what we said crudely, says that if we considered actually a sphere here and we were prepared to take suspensions, then there would be some equivalence between suspensions of this and suspensions of maps of that into a sphere. But here we have a statement on the nose that this free abelian group consisting of all configurations of positive and negative particles in X, where we allow them to come together, is the same as the maps of X into some other space. This is if X is an n-dimensional oriented manifold. N is the dimension of the manifold. So that's homological Poincaré duality for an n-dimensional manifold. Now, this space here is systems of particles on the sphere, or if you like, systems of particles in Rn, where you compactify them at infinity, you let them run away to infinity.
This might seem a very attractive statement to a physicist, in that you see, here you have an equivalence between some particle-like objects with some objects which are very spread out, some functions on x with values in some fixed thing. Now that's, again, very much the kind of duality we want in connection with S-dualities, in that things which become local and heavy in one picture tend to become totally diffuse in the other picture. So again, that's somewhat on the right track, but it's still not quite the way we want to go, I think, because these spaces are just far too singular. You can't really make, I mean, even if you take, say, the n-fold symmetric product of a space, one knows that if X is a manifold, its n-fold symmetric product is very singular. And if you try to make the free abelian group and run all these things together, you'll get something very singular indeed. Similarly, this space that we want to map into here, although it's a perfectly good space from the point of view of doing homotopy theory, it's a pretty awful object from the point of view of geometry. It's not in the least like a smooth manifold or anything. So this is actually a very singular picture. And of course we keep getting told by our great gurus that the great thing about string theory is it rescues one from things like this. It kind of sort of introduces just sufficient non-locality or something to smooth out these singularities that happen when points come together. So I'd like to, now one of the ways in which I've already tried to, well, I'd like to talk about, my ultimate object is really to talk about some k-theoretical translation of that statement. But at this point I'm going to begin a system of detours before I actually get to that. I mentioned that we might have wanted to do even better than compare two spaces. We might have wanted to make some kind of equivalence between actual objects. You see, K-theory was made out of vector bundles. A vector bundle is an actual thing. You know, you have a vector bundle on a manifold, and you can, for instance, not only ask is it isomorphic to another vector bundle, but you can ask whether, you can ask about its maps from one to another vector bundle. Now, why might we be interested in, I mean, what are the clues that we should really be interested in looking for some kinds of objects instead of just kind of elements of a group in our duality? So that's something better than just looking at a space. Well, actually, the clues go a long way back. In algebraic geometry for hundreds of years, people were tormented, really, by the question of making sense of the intersection of the intersection multiplicity with which algebraic varieties intersected each other. So I'm now changing ground a little bit in that I'm moving away from just spaces to spaces with some additional structure. You see, in algebraic geometry, we have, say, we're looking, say, in some complex vector space. We have some algebraic curves, and maybe they intersect. Well, they might intersect in some really quite strange way, so that they didn't go transversely across each other, but they touched. They might touch to some arbitrarily high order, or touch in a very complicated way if they're algebraic varieties of dimension greater than one. Still worse, algebraic varieties have singular points, and they might intersect at singular points, and one would still like to make sense of the intersection multiplicity. Now, again, measuring intersection multiplicity is certainly what Poincaré duality is about. I already explained it's about the cut product in cohomology, the intersection of cohomology classes. Now, this problem was eventually solved very satisfactorily, and let me just point out to you what the solution is. Supposing we're in, this is a local problem, so we can imagine we're looking at algebraic varieties in Cn for some n. Then we have, say, x that we want to intersect with y, these two varieties. Then what you do is look at the module of functions on x. So let me just write, f of x, because it's nothing like that, but mx. These are just the algebraic functions defined along x. So that would be the quotient of all polynomials on Cn by the ideal of functions that vanish on x. So it would be the sections of the structure sheaf Ox in the usual language. And we have these things My, and these are modules over the ring of functions, the polynomials on Cn, the globally defined functions, because you can restrict functions and then multiply. And the intersection multiplicity, people eventually realized, could be got in the following way. It was the Euler number of something you made by homological algebra. You see, supposing we were just to tensor these things together, then we would be taking, if these are functions, modulo functions that vanish on x, functions which vanish on y, if they intersect transversally, then any function which intersects, that vanishes on the intersection, can be written as the sum of a function that vanishes on one, something that vanishes on the other, and then this tensor product would just be the functions on x intersection y. But in general, that's not true. I mean, it's the problem of non-transversal intersections that this is all about. And people realize that the good definition of the intersection number was as the Euler characteristic of the sigma minus 1 to the I of the dimension of some things for I, some groups, which were the homology of a certain complex. So we had these two modules. Tor naught is just the tensor product, which I wrote there. But we have some higher things, and we take the alternating sum of their dimensions, and that is the good notion of intersection. Now, the important thing about this is that this is the homology groups of a certain chain complex, which we get by putting together the chain complex of X, a chain complex, well, some object associated to X, some chain complex made out of this, some chain complex made out of that. We do some operations that needn't concern us, and we take the alternating sum of these dimensions. In other words, as if it were the Euler characteristic of a space. And you see, what is this space? You see, what we're really saying is that these two cycles, which meet at this point, well, associated to this point, there's actually at least potentially some kind of space of which the chain complex was the thing whose homology groups were those groups Tor. Right? Now, this is a chain complex which is only going to be defined with complex coefficients, you see. So this is not going to be an honest topological space, but it's going to be one of these abstract entities which keep arising in physics, where we get some sequence of vector spaces with a differential, and something like a space arises. Well, of course, this fact that intersections really should become spaces has, let me just remind you, become very fashionable in string theory recently in connection with mirror symmetry. Some examples where one can, well, there are two famous, superficially very different examples where one promotes cycles in a manifold to objects and makes some cohomology associated to their intersection. And these are the two things that are conjecturally related by mirror symmetry. So, for instance, if one has a symplectic manifold, then one can make the following category. One can consider all the Lagrangian submanifolds in X. So consider these are the objects of a category. And what are the morphisms? Well, we're interested in morphisms which are going to somehow the idea of a morphism is the morphisms is they're going to be connected with the points of intersection of the manifold. So supposing we have y1 and y2, so these two things, all sitting inside X. Well, we'd like to define at least some cohomology. We'd like to define some space of morphisms from this to this. Or if we can't define an honest space, we'd like at least to define some cohomology, something which is potentially the cohomology of a space of morphisms, so that we could make an additive category with objects, this thing, where the morphisms from one to the other was a homology of this space. Now, at least in a variety of cases, that can be done by sort of Fukuya-Fleur theory. We consider all paths which begin on y1 and end on y2, and we put some action functional on these paths. So such a path, so the action functional, there's a symplectic form. Roughly speaking, the action functional is the amount of area you need to put in, measured in terms of a surface, in terms of the symplectic structure, to link this thing to an actual intersection point. I mean, it's the minimum bit of film you can put in to span this curve. Well, you do Morse theory for that action functional on the paths. Clearly, its obvious critical points are when the things intersect. And in fact, they're the only critical points. So the critical points of this thing correspond exactly to the points of intersection of the two submanifolds. So if we want to try and calculate in some way the cohomology of this infinite dimensional space of paths in some, by some infinite dimensional Morse theory using this thing, we'll be led to some chain complex, and it has Fleur cohomology, which we take to be this. And in that way, we actually, at least Fukuya, in at least a range of cases, can define a category whose objects are these things and whose spaces of morphisms are the Fleur homology of this, the loops going, the paths going from one to the other, the strings beginning on one and ending on the other. You want to think of them in terms of D-planes. But of course, there's a dual picture when X is a complex manifold. Well, conjecturally dual, there's at least another picture. Because then we're in the situation that I talked of a moment ago in algebraic geometry. You see, then when you have the natural thing to think about then is complex submanifolds. Complex submanifolds, I explained, at least in the local situation, you should think of as modules for the algebraic functions on the global variety X. So we consider complex submanifolds, Y contained in X, but and we think of them as being in terms of the sheaves of functions on them. So each one of these things gives a so-called coherent sheaf, namely the functions. And when you have two coherent sheaves, you again have, well, you have those tor groups, which is a homology of something. The corresponding cohomology is what would be called the X groups, if we had two of these things. So these are essentially dual to those tors that I had before. I don't want to say this in too much detail. We get some cohomology associated to these things, which, again, is very closely related to their intersections. And, of course, the great dream in mirror symmetry is that when you have a Calabi-Yau manifold, it is on the one hand a symplectic manifold, on the other a complex manifold, and we'd like to say that there's some kind of Poincaré duality or whatever that takes this category made out of paths between things and their Fleur cohomology to this category made out of coherent sheaves and X. Now, that's been carried out in great detail, maybe for an elliptic curve, and as far as I know, in no other example. But, I mean, it certainly, it's a program which has been mainly discussed and pushed by Koncevich, and he's done all sorts of things related to it. But, of course, the complete picture is totally missing at the moment still. Well, anyway, we want to go back to K-theory, or at least I'm still going to make another detour before getting there. I did tell you that we're now back to our compact space. I talked about a space of vector bundles on X Now I'm thinking more or less of spaces for the moment. So we'll take these virtual ones. So we could identify this, if we like, with the space of maps of X into some space of Fredholm operators or whatever. I talked about that in the last lecture. So this is one. This is a space which is the space of vector bundles. So the connected components of that space are the K-theory of X in the usual sense. So phi naught of this is the K-theory of X by definition.
What are the correspondence
here? It's totally unknown.
Totally unknown.
Yeah, I think, is that a fair statement? Well,
you didn't say that
these
different
parallels. Oh, sorry.
I was
forgetting what I was saying. Absolutely.
Some kind of progress.
Yeah, I'm terribly sorry, yes. There's meant to be this kind of, let me just say correctly what at least I meant to say. The idea is that given a Calabi-Yau manifold, there's meant to be another Calabi-Yau manifold, namely its mirror, such that this category for one is the same, is equivalent to that category for the other, and vice versa. So passing between these two manifolds is meant to flip the two categories. So these are meant to be like a sort of homological style thing and a cohomological style thing, if you maybe. But as far as I know, there's very little idea what really is behind this. But certainly the person I suppose you'd have to ask is Koncevich. Fair enough statement. Okay, so we go back to this thing where we considered the space of vector bundles, and I was trying to tell you also another space. So notice that this is contravariant in X. I want to tell you another space. I have already told you another space which is covariant in X. Remember, I considered what I call the non-abelian spectrum. I took the continuous functions on X, and I took the homomorphisms, the algebra homomorphisms, of that into the n by n matrices, complex matrices, and I took the union of that for all n, where you can think of matrices as being larger matrices where you just fill in by zeros. This is exactly the same thing as the space. No, it's a space, right? Sorry, no. I didn't mean to say. I meant to take the union where you put each matrix algebra in the next by putting on zero. Sorry. Yeah. This is the same thing as the homomorphisms of C of X into the thing I call K, the C star algebra of compact operators in Hilbert space. Because why are they exactly the same? Well, you see, it's less complicated than you think, really, because this is a ring without a 1. So here I mean algebra homomorphisms that don't take 1 to 1, because there's no 1 to take it to. The 1 in this thing has to go to an idempotent in here. The idempotents all have a finite rank. So even though I did put these things, as it were, all into one object, it will come out to be a disjoint union over the number of points, capital N, because the element 1 in here will have to go to a projection operator which has a definite rank. So I called this, I gave this some off-the-cuff kind of notation last time. Let me give it a slightly more systematic notation. I'll call that K sub X. This is covariant in X. You see, because the functions on X are contravariant in X, but then I'm taking the homomorphisms from the functions into something, this is covariant again. And remember that I pointed out that such a thing, such a homomorphism, is essentially a bunch of capital N points of X, each labeled with some eigenspace information. So this is some kind of thickening up of the N, for a particular N, this is some kind of thickening up of the n-fold symmetric product of X. And it's very, very close, has the same rational homology, at least, as the nth Hilbert scheme of X in the case when this is an algebraic surface, which was the case Robert Dijkgraaf was talking about. And it's also something that you can see, at least another version of this space looked at rationally, at least, we can see in terms of the sort of way you do so-called orbifold compactifications in string theory. Again, that's something I hope to talk about in the next lecture, but not now. Now, I would like to say that there was some kind of, that Poincaré duality in K-theory was some kind of equivalence between this space and this space. However, those spaces are not, at the moment, quite equivalent. And in the next lecture, I want to try and explain that the difference between this space and this space is that this one, so to speak, has all the brains in. The connected components here correspond to the K-theory elements, whereas this one doesn't. I'll talk about why that should be so. But let's So let me first of all just tell you another point of view on this, and why, how this Poincaré duality is coming about. Let's think of what. Let's promote this. You see, I'd like to say these are somehow dual objects. That's perhaps not too amazing, but let me try and promote that to a category theoretical statement. Let me actually consider the category of vector spaces, of vector bundles on X. And now let me think again what this is. A homomorphism of C of X into the n by n matrices, that's just an action of C of X on the vector space Cn. So this is, so these objects, the point of that space is a finite dimensional C of X module. So here we have two categories, the category of vector bundles on X and these things. You see, to give a finite dimensional vector space on which this acts is exactly the same thing as to give a homomorphism into the n by n matrices, just tautologically. So we have these two categories. And remember, we already said earlier that this is the same thing as finitely generated so-called projective C of X modules. This was this Swan isomorphism that I talked about in the last lecture. Now, why should these categories be dual? Well, this was, in fact, when Grothendieck first introduced K-theory in the context of algebraic geometry, he introduced two different kinds of K-theory simultaneously. He was interested in, he, of course, didn't talk about vector bundles. He talked about locally free coherent sheaves. That's, in this context, projective modules over C of X. And he also talked about coherent sheaves on the variety. That's the analog of this thing. And he pointed out that if the variety is non-singular, that's the condition we always have in these Poincaré duality-like things, then the K-theory made from the category of coherent sheaves was the same as the K-theory made from the category of vector bundles by taking resolutions. But let's think about this in our baby example where X is just a compact space. I claim there's a natural pairing. Given an object here and an object here, you get a vector space, a finite dimensional vector space. So I write vect for the category of finite dimensional vector spaces. Well, how do we get that? Well, you see, what is this module? As I've already pointed out, if we have X, what a point here is a collection of points, X1, up to xk, each labeled with some vector space, the corresponding eigenspace when you diagonalize the action of cx on c of n. So this gives you some vector spaces whose dimension add up to capital N. On the other hand, an object here, E, however we look at it, it gives us a vector space Ex for each point of x. So if you want to put that together with that, the natural way to pair them is to take the sum over I of V of xi tensored with E of xi, where this sum, perhaps we should write it xi, it's a sum over the support of this thing. You see, this is supported at a number of points where we have finite dimensional vector spaces. Well, it's an essentially easy but slightly bewildering exercise to prove that this pairing of additive category cross additive category to the category of finite dimensional vector spaces is a perfect duality, in the sense that if you consider additive functors from vector spaces into finite dimensional vector spaces, from vector bundles on X to finite dimensional vector spaces, well, what such functions, what such functors do you have? Well, you basically have evaluation at points and sums of such things, and not much else. In fact, nothing else. This is precisely evaluation tensored with fixed vector spaces at the points. Even more obviously, if you wanted a functor from this into vector spaces, then you see, for each, you've got to say what to do with any object like this. So supposing you just consider things supported, consider the object which is just one-dimensional supported at a point, that will go to some finite dimensional vector space. As this thing runs around, we'll get a varying family of vector spaces, in other words, a vector bundle on here. So this is a perfect additive duality. And the duality that I want to talk about is a duality, this homotopy equivalence is meant to be the expression of that vector space duality, and also expressing the duality between finitely generated predictive modules and all finitely generated modules in K-theory. The advantage of saying it in terms of modules and projective modules is that it makes sense, again, for a non-commutative ring. It's something that happens in non-commutative geometry. Well, you can also see here what's the problem about brains. Well, supposing I have an additive functor from vector spaces, from vector bundles on X to vector spaces, what ones can you think of? The only obvious ones are taking a vector bundle and associating to it its fiber at some point. I claim that the only possible functors are finite sums of things like that. It's an honest statement, but I don't want to tell you the proof now, because the proof, it's a very good exercise, but I'll tell you, if you can't do it, I'll tell you later. conversely, if you had a functor from this into vector spaces, then in particular it would have to take a inside this category, we have for each point of X the object that has just the complex numbers at that point and nothing anywhere else. So we would have to associate to that object a vector space, which would depend on X. So on this side, I'm putting on some kind of continuity in terms of the object. That would give me a family of finite dimensional vector spaces. And it would be a vector bundle, so an object of this. And the thing would be clearly completely determined by, if it's an additive functor, by what it did to those objects. Now, you see, this is a baby example of what happens in algebraic geometry. Because over C of X, we don't have a reasonable notion of coherent sheaf. We can take finite dimensional vector spaces and action of the functions on them, and that gives you these objects which are supported at points. But in algebraic geometry, we have all these tricky in-between things where we have not just naught-dimensional things, but finite dimensional submanifolds, and we have the sheaves of holomorphic functions along those, which are some kind of, they're precisely what's called coherent sheaves. They're a nice category of things which is meant to correspond to the category of finite rank modules over the original ring. But you see, you can't do that outside a holomorphic context. Well, at this point I'm going to begin my last... in order to make these two things equivalent in this context, we have to add some more objects to this corresponding to things which are actually supported on things which are not naught dimensional. And that's what I meant by saying that on this side we'd be leaving out the brains and we have to put them back in. Now let me begin my last digression. And that will be then the end of this lecture, and any pulling together of these different strands will then have to happen tomorrow in my last lecture. Well, in the context of just compact spaces and continuous functions, it's kind of well known you can't do that. I mean, there's no stopping place between points and the whole thing. I mean, there's no notion of a nice, in a compact space, there's no notion of a sort of codimension K submanifold. We need more structure before we can start discussing this. You see, so this would be a very, very baby homotopy theoretical construction.
But you didn't mean to say that you needed those.
One would need those to say that yes, two things were equivalent. Yeah, the thing made out of that if X were a manifold, and I wanted to say the thing made out of vector bundles was equivalent to the thing. I didn't need to put the brains in to get the pairing. I needed to say to put that in to get the Poincaré duality aspect of it. Now, I think actually it's getting a bit late. I better begin my last digression. Remember, I introduced these bundles of algebras that were classified by H3 with integer coefficients in the last lecture. And I want to go back to that because I want to go back to this question of promoting things from the level of spaces to the level of categories and discuss that in connection with cohomology. So I think it's best not to, as I'm so late, it's better not to motivate it. I want to spend my last minutes telling you about so-called delinear cohomology. Now, I can see that this is going to displease at least all the mathematicians in the audience for a variety of reasons. So I make some apology for that. The theory that I'm about to tell you has been discovered and rediscovered in various forms by lots of people in lots of contexts, and certainly not by me. A lot of mathematicians, particularly those interested in the kind of area of the subject represented here, have thought out this in their own way. Certainly, Beers has written things about it with Mike Hopkins, and Dan Fried has, and I know that David Morrison has in the section which he wrote on abelian duality in the great lecture note volume, which we're all waiting for. So I'm going to give you a kind of my attitude to delinear cohomology, so-called, in the smooth context. And I'm going to say it all very unhistorically. It arose in algebraic geometry and number, in fact, even more specifically, arithmetic algebraic geometry and number theory, where delinear had it in mind. It had actually already arisen in just a tiny, slightly modified version in the smooth context in work of Cheeger and Simons, but essentially it's also implicit in the very construction of Chern-Simons forms and so on in gauge theory. So it has an enormous parentage of all kinds. And the main thing I want to emphasize is I'm claiming no originality whatever for any of these remarks. And everyone who discusses the subject has their own point of view on it, and I've never met anyone who agrees that my point of view is the best, except me.
And we all feel that.
Yes. So I'm afraid all the mathematicians really should leave the room at this point. So the observation is this, that, well, there are a number of possibly slightly different observations. One of the observations is that when you have a in the smooth category, when you have a vector bundle with a unitary connection, it has, of course, Chern classes, which are integral cohomology classes, but by the Chern-Vey procedure, using the curvature of the connection, you can write down explicit representatives of these as differential forms. So if you have, so now X is a smooth manifold, And we're interested in the smooth Hermitian vector bundle with a connection. Then, to this, we can associate Chern classes, Ci of x, which lie in H2i of x with integer coefficients. We can also, by means of curvature, write down differential form representatives, which will be specific differential forms on x, smooth differential forms in the same degree. And, of course, these will be closed, and they will represent that cohomology class. Now, the first observation is that it's worth keeping track of both of these things simultaneously, putting them into one package. So inventing a sort of heightened Chern class for a bundle, which reflects both the bundle and the connection, lies in something which contains both of those pieces of information. Now, that requires a certain amount of homological algebra cunning, in that how do you exactly encode the fact that a differential form represents a certain integer cohomology class? Well, it's obviously too late to tell you that, but one can do it, and that gives us the delinear cohomology group of X in dimension 2i. Well, we can define delinear cohomology in any dimension, but these ones, of course, will be even ones, but let's do it in a general dimension P. And this has two what you might call forgetful maps. One going into integral cohomology, and the other going into P forms. In fact, closed P forms. Both of these maps are surjective, and their kernels are what you might think. So I'll write them down and then motivate them. In this case, you get P minus 1 forms modulo what I'll call P minus 1 Z. This means closed with integral periods. Sorry? Wait a minute. Sorry? What? With integral periods. If I want it to be subjective. And the kernel of this one is, so this is finite dimensional, so to speak, and this is infinite dimensional. This is the other way around. That's infinite dimensional. And here we have something finite dimensional, P minus 1 of x with circle coefficients. So these groups satisfy these two basic exact sequences. Now, that's out of the blue, so let me first of all tell you the low dimensional examples. Examples. Well, H naught delinear is just the maps from X into Z, continuous maps. So it's the same as ordinary H naught with integer coefficients. H1 is also not terribly interesting. It's the continuous, the smooth maps from X into the circle. Right, the actual maps, not homotopy classes of maps. You see, the homotopy class of map is an integral element of H1. So let's check what happens there. You see, if you have a map of x into the circle, it determines an element of H1 with integer coefficients. When is that zero? Well, precisely when the map is the integral of a one form on the circle. Precisely when... I think I've got muddled. I think I'll let you think that out. The interesting case is H2D, which is precisely the isomorphism classes of line bundles with with connection, unitary connection on X.
You see, so this, if P is 2, we have the first Chern class. If the first Chern class is trivial, then the line bundle is trivial as a bundle. In that case, the connection can be represented globally by a smooth one form. That's unique up to gauge transformations, and the possibilities of changing it by a gauge transformation, you can change it by closed one forms with integral periods. Conversely, if you have a bundle, it has its curvature, which is a closed two-form with integral periods. If you get zero in there, the thing is flat. It's a flat bundle. A flat bundle, this would then be 1, is simply an element of H1 with circle coefficients, a map from the fundamental group of X into the circle. So you certainly see those two things very clearly in this case. And of course, H3D is the isomorphism classes of bundles of algebras, in the sense I talked about yesterday with connection. Morita equivalence classes, I suppose. But with connection. You see, and then the class that would come out here is the integral H3, or equivalently of what are called gerbs, which I haven't said anything about so far except to say they're more or less the same as that. Why am I bringing this digression in just right here? I mean, there are a number of reasons. If we go to H4, we will get the kind of object which is the piece of information in 11 dimensions that a manifold has to be equipped with for one to do supergravity in dimension 11. I mean, the kinds of objects that are being studied are manifold together with something that will be delinear H4. But as I've only got a few minutes now, I just want to make a little bit of propaganda for this picture. And say how it's related to my theme of Poincaré duality. And then, perhaps this will also have to wait for the next lecture. I'll just say a few words, as I won't get it into this lecture, but I will say a bit more about it next time. These things I've defined are groups. So they're not objects. But clearly they've got objects lying behind them. Here we have a line bundle with connection. Here we have this funny, mysterious kind of thing called a gerb. And if we went to H4, we'd get the thing which people sometimes call a two-gerb. And they're objects which are somehow very hard to make precise. And it gets worse and worse as you go up. There is a systematic way of doing it, but it's the kind of thing which no reasonable person would want to know. You have to talk about categories, two categories, three categories, and so on. I'm not going to try and convert you to that by any means. On the other hand, the reason why these things were invented is that an actual bundle with a connection has Chern classes which lie in these groups. And in fact, that it not only has Chern classes which lie in these groups, but it gives rise to well-defined objects up to isomorphism which arise in these different dimensions. Now this is something of a peculiar situation. You see, when you're trying to classify string backgrounds or whatever, I don't know quite what the right word is, in superstring theory, you want Riemannian manifolds equipped with B fields and then all of these Ramond-Ramon things. What the Ramond-Ramon things are, certainly they give you elements of these groups in various dimensions. And it's pretty clear that they give you actual objects. And it's hard somehow to make sense of them. On the other hand, it's very easy to make sense of bundles with connection. And it's somewhat mysterious whether what's really there is these delinear style objects or
some K-theoretical thing. Well, I'll try and talk more about that. I'll just end with my little piece of propaganda for Delinea cohomology. What can we do? Let me try and explain to you some important things about it. One thing is that, it has lots of properties which I don't have too much time to tell you about. One is that if, for instance, you have a map from X to Y, which is a vibration of manifolds, with, say, compact oriented fibers of dimension P, then there's an integration along the fiber map which takes Hi Delinea of X to Hi minus P Delinea of X of Y. So, of course, if there were differential forms, you could integrate them along the fibers, but you can integrate these things, and you can actually integrate the objects. Now, that's very important for strengthenings of the Ettier-Singer index theorem in the following sort of way. In the index theorem, you often have some elliptic operator on this space, and you're interested in restricting it to the fibers and taking its index along the fibers and getting some kind of object down there. And one has a fibered Riemann-Roch theorem, a Riemann-Roch for index theorem for families, which tell one how to do that in the level of characteristic classes on the level of K-theory. Well, there's a strengthened theorem which tells you how to do it on the level of these things, and that will, for instance, tell you, for instance, if you have some class up here which has an index class down there, which one ordinarily thinks of just as an element of K-theory, it will, for instance, have its first Chern class, which is a line bundle with connection, and that will have holonomy around paths down here, and one will have all kinds of holonomy theorems for the determinant line of an index bundle which make use of maps like this. Anyway, we have this integration. But the only thing that I have time to say about it now is that if X is again compact oriented dimension N, then H N plus 1 Delinea of X is isomorphic to the circle. That follows from those sequences, and of course above that the groups are all zero. And the important thing is that the theory H star D has Poincaré duality with respect to this, in the sense that HP Delinea of X, well, the theory has products, I should have said, first of all, so you can multiply things in any two dimensions and get things in the sum of the two dimensions. So we should take N plus 1 minus P D of X. And we'll get into H N plus 1 D of X, which is a circle. And this makes each of these groups the Pontryagin dual of each other. Each of these groups is the homomorphisms of the other into the circle. So, now this thing is something from which one can read off standard homological Poincaré duality, but it is a considerable strengthening of ordinary Poincaré duality. Just to give you an idea of how it might be a kind of strengthening, there are many, many quite deep examples, but the very simplest one is one which is very basic for me. You see, supposing you take X to be a circle, then H1D of X, what we said, is the map of the circle into the circle. The second circle is the group. The first one is just any circle, not parametrized, just a compact one-dimensional manifold. So there should be a product. Let's call that gamma, because it's a loop group. Well, let's call it L, because it's a loop group. Maybe that would be more what I was doing. So we should have a product map, L cross L, going into T, which is H2D of S1. And, of course, it should be skew, as in all cup products. What is it? Well, it's the co-cycle which defines the important central extension of this loop group. If these things had winding number zero, so you could write them as e to the if, where f was a real valued function, this would be the thing that took e to the if, e to the ig, to e to the I integral of f dg around the circle. But, of course, if the things don't have winding number zero, to get the co-cycle of this central extension requires fiddling around with the winding numbers and so on. I won't talk about that now. But you need a distinctly more fiddly formula than this to write down that co-cycle. But it arises here just as the cup product in the linear cohomology. Well, it's time for me to stop it, isn't it? So I think I... what could I say by way of propaganda? The sort of thing... I'll just say one tiny bit more propaganda. If you read the account of Witten's lectures on dynamics of field theories, there's a chapter called Abelian Duality, which... remember I began by talking about the Ising model. Well, in a sense, we're going back to it here in the following way. You see, these are infinite dimensional spaces for a certain manifold. And here we're saying that two things are in Pontryagin duality. But if you're studying some theory of Abelian gauge fields on some manifold X, we have some path integral which we can write as an integral over a space here. We can then do Fourier transform to write as an integral over a space there and get a dual gauge theory. Now, it would be nice to explain lots of things in connection with that, but I clearly don't have time to now. But certainly, this pairing is what gives you the sort of action which you read about if you want to do, say, Abelian electric magnetic duality on a four-dimensional manifold, where you see if you... Well, I think I really don't have time to explain this properly. H2D is the line bundles with connection, so they're the electromagnetic fields. The thing that's Pontryagin dual to, you see, will be H1D, which is the functions into the circle. So when you do your Fourier transform, you get into functions on circle-valued functions. All I've done so far is the Poincaré duality, right? But we... X is four. I was talking about X is four-dimensional. No, all I said was that in four dimensions, we have this Pontryagin duality between line bundles with connection and circle-valued functions. That's a Pontryagin duality. But now, of course, to get something on the level of field theories, we have to do something more about it. I mean, we want to write down two partition functions as functions of something. So what do we do? We need still to twist that by introducing some observable or something to get... I mean, we don't just want to write down the Fourier transform of the Lagrangian of the theory. That's all I've been telling you, motivating there. But we have to then integrate this over something or multiply it by something and integrate, and that will come out to be the electric magnetic duality in four dimensions. Maybe I might actually say that next time, because I think that is worth perhaps getting right. And it does require only a couple of minutes of further discussion on the basis of that, at least to explain the formalism. I think I should stop now anyway.